Hello and welcome to Ego Justice Radio here on 90.7 KPFK. My name is JP Morris, and today we have an interview hosted by Carrie Kim. She'll be talking to Ryan Henson, the Senior Policy Director of Cal Wild. But first, words from the front. And today's words from the front is from Robert Pope of publicwatchdogs.org.
Hi, my name is Robert Pope. I am a geologist and chief scientist with publicwatchdogs.org. I'm speaking with you today about the issue that we have with the burial of nuclear waste at the San Onofre State Beach. Where we're at today is that Edison is moving forward with burial of high-level nuclear waste on the beach, literally less than 15 feet above mean sea level, within just a couple feet of groundwater, and only one-third of a football field from high tide at San Onofre State Beach. In Edison's application to get this facility permitted for storage, they actually acknowledge that 50 years from now, the ocean will have washed this area of land away, yet they asked for permission to bury the waste at this location, and the California Coastal Commission actually granted that permission. Where we're at right now is we are stating our case for revocation of that permit to bury the waste on the beach, and I believe we have a fantastic chance of actually attaining revocation of that permit. And the way people can help us revoke that permit is to go to publicwatchdogs.org online. You can learn more on our website. You can make contributions that help support us in putting together the scientific and engineering arguments that will cause the California Coastal Commission to recognize that this is an unsafe act to bury the nuclear waste on the beach and to cause them to change their mind, to take a re-vote, and to revoke that permit, forcing Edison to come up with another solution. There's no excellent solution to managing nuclear waste. It's a really tough problem, but we know that the answer is not burying it on a sensitive beach. So I'm sure we're going to come up with a better answer, and we appreciate the public's help and support for us doing that work. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. And now our interview with Ryan Henson. You're listening to Eco Justice Radio here on 90.7 KPFK.
Aloha. You're listening to Eco Justice Radio on 90.7 KPFK. My name is Carrie Kim, and we're here with Ryan Henson. Ryan Henson is a Senior Policy Director for the California Wilderness Coalition, also known as Cal Wild. The California Wilderness Coalition protects and restores the state's wildest natural landscapes and watersheds on public lands. Cal Wild is the only statewide organization dedicated solely to protecting and restoring the wild places and native biodiversity of California's public lands. Ryan, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Could you first, for our listeners, explain the difference between a national monument and a national park?
That's a great question. So in law, a national park has to be designated by Congress. A national monument can be designated by the President of the United States. Both of them have to be on existing federal lands. That's something that they have in common. That's one essential difference. And then typically, you can't hunt in national parks, while in many national monuments, you can still hunt and do other things that sometimes are prohibited in parks.
Thanks so much for clarifying that, because I think a lot of people actually don't really know the difference, and it's important that we understand, especially now with all the threats that are coming to both, actually. And I'm wondering now if you could also explain the Antiquities Act of 1906.
Sure. So Congress, earlier I said that the President of the United States has the authority to establish national monuments, and the law that gave presidents that authority is the Antiquities Act. And Congress gave presidents the authority to identify objects, is the word that it used, object word that Congress used, objects of value. And that has, over the years, since the law was first established, consisted, the word objects has been interpreted to consist of everything from areas of high archaeological value, like cliff dwellings in the American Southwest, to whole ecosystems, like the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, Southern Oregon, and far northern California, where there the object of value is an entire unique ecosystem. So, yeah, the Antiquities Act gave presidents the authority to protect such places, and it has to be the smallest practicable area. So if it's an ecosystem, then it can be a very large place. But if the object of value is, and this is a real-world scenario, Cesar Chavez's birthplace, the Cesar Chavez National Monument, was established by President Obama, then that's a fairly small area.
Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on the show is, as many listeners may be or may not be aware, that in April, President Trump had ordered the Department of the Interior to review all designations of national monuments greater than 100,000 acres created since 1996. And what I understand is it put at risk maybe 24 monuments. You can probably clarify a bit more about that. And if you could explain really where we are, I believe the review is complete now, and what's at stake now for these monuments.
Sure. And there's still some uncertainty in this, thanks to the Trump administration, but as I'll explain. So, as I said, presidents have the authority under the Antiquities Act to protect lands as national monuments. What hasn't been tested is whether or not presidents have the authority, just by executive declaration, to roll back a national monument, to strip the land of national monument status, or if it's not an area of land, a historic building or something like that. So that has never been tested in the courts, and it seems that most scholars agree that it is probably illegal. Nevertheless, the Trump administration declared that it would review all national monuments established by, basically from President Bill Clinton onward, all of the large national monuments and many marine monuments as well. And as you said, it affected, I believe it was 27 in all, if you include the marine monuments, and including 7 in California, and those are the ones that I was involved defending. And as you said, the review is now over, according to Interior Secretary Zinke. He forwarded, I forgot to say what the review was technically for. So the review was to find out whether or not there was insufficient public input in the establishment of these monuments by previous presidents, which in the case of the California monuments is pretty ridiculous because they were all very widely supported at the time that they were protected. And I can't speak to the other 20,
mm-hmm.
but they were definitely supported. So Interior Secretary Zinke said that he is done with his review, and he forwarded his recommendations to the White House, but failed to share them with the public. So we don't know what his recommendations are. However, the press, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, a leaked copy of the recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Or what we hope are the entirety of the recommendations, but see, okay. we don't know,
mm-hmm.
And it appears that there will be, I think it was seven monuments. I do focus on California. That is a handicap. But yeah, I believe it was 7 monuments, including one that California shares with Oregon, Cascade Siskiyou, that I mentioned previously.
Mm-hmm.
So. That's where we are. We have a leaked copy of what may or may not be the entirety of the recommendations. Recommendations to weaken. Oh, and I neglect to say one other thing, and it's hard to keep track of because the administration literally dribbled out news over time in the strangest way I've ever encountered. But they also announced that they actually would not ask that any national monuments be disestablished. I'm not even sure what the word is.
It's never been tried.
So, okay. Yeah, they said that that no national monuments would be disestablished. However, they might try to shrink them or change the way that they're managed. And those shrinking has been done by previous presidents, very small reductions in size, 8 times, but none of them prior to 1976, when Congress made such things more difficult. And those previous 8 times were so non-controversial that they were never challenged in court. So again, many legal scholars, I'd even venture to say most, feel that the president lacks the authority to shrink or reduce protections for monuments that were designated by their predecessors.
Okay. And then what about the changing of the way they are managed? Because does that allow private industry to then come into these lands, even if they remain as national monuments in status?
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. In the case of one I'm familiar with, for example, the Carrizo Play National Monument, it's sitting on a significant amount of oil, and much of the region around it, it's west of Bakersfield in Kern County and in San Luis Obispo mm-hmm. County, I should add.
Okay.
And much of the landscape around it has been developed already for oil. So we have this one place, this amazing vestige of San Joaquin Valley Prairie that's really important to the Chumash tribe and to thousands of people who flock there every year to see the amazing wildflower displays. You know, we're saving this vestige of San Joaquin Valley Prairie. That happens to be sitting on top of the Monterey Shale deposit, one of the richest oil deposits in North America.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we are very concerned about the potential weakening of some of these monuments. We could have in theory, we could have a Carrizo Plain National Monument with oil rigs all through it.
So that wouldn't
make a mockery of protection.
Right. So
it's possible.
So that necessarily wouldn't be something that could be protected legally, you believe?
Well, you mean like through the courts?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it'll be comical, all the lawyers trying to fit through the courthouse door at the same time, on the day that that the president does officially release the National Monument recommendations, because they will be challenged by nearly every conservation group, many, many tribes, I don't know how many, businesses and local governments as well, possibly even the state of California.
You're listening to EcoJustice Radio on 90.7 KPFK and Ryan Henson of Cal Wild. So Ryan, that's actually the good news, I guess, that people are just waiting with bated breath to be able to then kind of come in there as the cavalry. But if you could, do you have any idea when there's going to be a greater formal announcement? You know, we only have this
absolutely
leaked.
Absolutely not. Yeah. I'm completely in the dark about it, as are many others.
Well, if you could also share with us, you know, what does this mean as far as, has there really been a change in the perceived value and purpose of our public lands? Is it something that people have just been sleeping on, and they have just taken for granted these monuments and national parks, that they will always be here, protected?
Well, folks are certainly enjoying them, actually, in record numbers. The National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Forest Service are all finding enormous increases in the number of people visiting our national parks and mm-hmm. other public lands.
Mm-hmm.
And in California, a great increase in the diversity of the people using our public lands, though in part that's because they finally started counting people in such a way as to count a lot more Latinos, for example.
Uh-huh.
So for example, they were hanging out at trailheads waiting to interview hikers, most of whom were non-Latino, but they were failing to go to the picnic sites and the places where folks were swimming.
I see.
You know, And so folks are visiting in record numbers. So I think people in some cases are still learning about them. So I'm loath to say that they take them for granted so much.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the Trump administration is certainly reminding us that we definitely should not take them for granted.
Yeah, well, I remember the interview that I had read with you where you had said, "It's over my dead body time," regarding protection of our wild spaces. So
I regret using language like that, but that is a sincere feeling that I felt, and I'm in this, you know, because it is in many ways a very personal thing. It's sort of my calling, and these lands are very important to me. They've been important to me my whole life, and I have to say the Trump administration poses, for the first time, really an existential threat that I didn't think I'd have to witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always been kind of something that's been bipartisanly supported and sort of not a party-oriented thing to protect.
Largely, yes, absolutely. In fact, I've at one shining point, I had worked with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans in on land conservation issues.
Although it's funny to look at the breakdown, though, of some of the monuments that were threatened. Most of them were designated either by President Clinton or President Obama that I could see, and maybe one by President Bush.
Yes, yeah, and that's in part due to, I guess, one thing I neglected to say is they particularly wanted to focus on monuments over 100,000 acres in size.
Right.
And by the time President Obama became president, it was already well recognized that presidents had the authority to protect ecosystems. And I mean, I'll give you one example. The giant Sequoia National Monument here in California, we can't just draw circles around the giant trees and think we're protecting the giant Sequoia ecosystem. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's an entire ecosystem that relates to other ecosystems, other types of trees, and whole other types of plant life and everything, and so you have to protect
multiple
a good sized region to mm-hmm. protect the giant sequoia ecosystem.
Really, how much would we need to protect, do you think, acreage wise? I mean, really, what would that entail, do you think?
Well, President Clinton did it. I mean, he established the giant sequoia national monument, which really complements the protections already for giant sequoias already afforded by Yosemite National Park and Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park, which contain the most spectacular and most intact remaining giant sequoia growth.
Yeah, it's hard to even imagine, you know, that's such a national treasure. It's such a icon of California. It's hard to imagine someone wanting to, say, for example, go through there and log it or whatever could possibly happen in the sequoias, you know, by private industry. What would you do there? You know, we know that a lot of the things that we're subject to, things like extraction of fossil fuels or mining or water privatization, like what's happening with the Cadiz issue and the Mojave. So.
Oh, I'm so glad you're aware of that. And the Cadiz water grab is right underneath a national monument, the Mojave Trails National Monument.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've been covering that as well. And, you know, right now, it seems given everything that's happening with climate change, it's now more than ever we should be preserving and expanding protections of our monuments and making more designations, not less, and not shrinking, definitely not shrinking.
I certainly agree. And, you know, we can increase the diversity of the places that are recognized and protected as well. You know, the Antiquities Act is, as you've said, is a very old law, passed back in the aughts, and over time, our definition of our heritage kind of changes, and who knows what we'll protect, what we'll be hopefully be setting aside 100 years from now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I also wanted to ask you a question when you mentioned about the fact that the park attendance has sort of been in record numbers and is upticking. I also wanted to ask, because I had read something saying that there was some concern, this is more maybe in the national park system, that the younger generation, you know, the uptick in attendance isn't really in the younger generation. It's kind of more the baby boomer generation, and that our younger youth generations aren't so much invested in the parks as maybe they should be in order to be stewards of it going forward. What do you think about that?
Well, that is definitely something to be concerned about. I am pleased to always see a lot of young people visiting our public lands. I'm pleased to see a lot of young people in the conservation movement. I don't know. I do know that among the very young, particularly teenagers, there's definitely a concern in this age of electronics that, you know, kids aren't getting outside enough just in general.
Sure.
I'm not aware of what the demographic trends are. I do know, though, that millennials are getting out a lot to public lands.
That's
good. It's cheap.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, definitely it is. Well, you know, hopefully, you know, more programs will be developed to actually ensure that our youth spend more time there. I think part of it is just they're just not out there, but the more time they spend there, they may wish to have more time there.
You know, and over the years, I have seen just a huge growth in the number of programs and efforts to get kids out. You know, particularly underprivileged kids, and I'm really thinking that that's just going to pay off big time in the decades to come.
I think that's incumbent upon us all to try to ensure that our youth and people who may not have ever seen or set foot in a national park are exposed to it. So it's what we're familiar with, right? And so if we help them develop that familiarity and relationship with nature, that's fundamental.
Absolutely.
So now,
It also builds a constituency for these lands that they own, and that can be threatened from time to time. And when we have a large constituency, you know, we have more defenders for the lands when that time comes.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that was brought to my attention, and it was by an Indigenous friend, and they were mentioning about a lot of the parks and monuments have actually involved a lot of displacement from people from their ancestral lands. And I wonder what you have to say about that. So I know there's while we have this wonderful system, underlying that there is sort of the same kind of sordid history of land grabbing of our own. So I wonder what you have to say about that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting issue, and it's an ongoing one in some parts of the planet. Here, you emailed me that question, and so I pondered it in terms of what I'm familiar with, which is California. And our oldest national park is Yosemite, and it actually goes all the way back to the Civil War, its first colonel. And there were still Indigenous people living in what would become the park at the time.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, however, and I got to say, I'm actually not familiar with how I don't know if they were forcibly relocated as part of the park or if they were forced off the land, as most Native people were, just prior.
Sure.
But I do know that the first people who ran what would become Yosemite National Park was the U.S. Army, and specifically the famous Buffalo soldiers who were noted fighters of in the Indian Wars of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, it's hard to, it'd make a very interesting study about Native people and Yosemite National Park. However, most national parks in California aren't that old, and by the time that they were established, the native people had already been forcibly removed from the land, and the land had been largely taken over by miners and sheep herders and lumbermen, as they used to be called, and folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, then now, ironically, one of the few places where people can learn about Native California, and including the genocide inflicted on Native California, are in our national parks,
mm-hmm.
Especially our national parks. Places like Lava Beds National Monument are, which a huge part of that experience is the Modoc War, the resistance of the Modoc people against being forcibly removed from the land by the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge part of the national park experience here in California, and one of the few places, where people can get that knowledge about our native people and the genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, these lands are important to all of us, and especially to those who first inhabited it. And, I am wondering if you could share what you think are the best actions people can take to help you, Cal Wild, and all of our other environmental allies to protect our parks and monuments right now at this time.
Sure. Well, I think that one of the most important things folks can do is contact their members of Congress and let them know how important public lands are to you, and to stand strong for them, to ensure that they are protected, and also stage two, that they receive the funding they need. Even though use of these lands is increasing, the agencies are looking at closing campgrounds and things like that because they just aren't getting funding from Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to protecting our public lands, we need money to properly sustain and steward them. So that, I think, is the most important thing folks could do. Contact your members of Congress and tell them how much you love our public lands.
Yes, and also donate to them, yes?
Oh, absolutely.
To their programs.
Those I heard on public radio tonight, those who can't do should donate, and so definitely bear that in mind.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Could you just give us Cal Wild's URL? Is it calwild.org?
Yes.
Okay.
CALWILD.org.
And then also you're on Facebook?
We are, yes. It's California Wilderness Coalition.
California Wilderness Coalition. So listeners, I hope you will all look up the California Wilderness Coalition, stay abreast of what they're up to, and become their allies. And when we all contact our representatives and senators and let everyone know that we want to protect these public lands and help them to remain public and of benefit for us all. Thank you. Mahalo for listening to Ryan Henson of Cal Wild and Eco Justice Radio on 90.7 KPFK. Tune in next time.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to EcoJustice Radio here on 90.7 KPFK. I also want to thank Ryan Henson for coming on the show. EcoJustice Radio is brought to you by SoCal 350 and KPFK. Executive producer Mark Morris. Interview hosted by Carrie Kim, and original music by Javier Cadre. My name is JP Morris, and until next time, remember, the power is yours.